You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is Tea Break Archaeology, where we explore the ancient origins of everyday objects. Hello and welcome to episode 41 of Tea Break Archaeology. I'm Matilda Siebrecht, and this is part two of our Tea Break with Lisa Fagan-Davis, and we are talking all about that most intriguing of medieval manuscripts, the Voynich manuscript. So last episode, we talked a little bit about why this manuscript is so intriguing and what we do know about it, what we don't know about it. But I'm very curious. I mean, you mentioned at the end of the last episode that you are probably the person who studied this manuscript the most up until this point. What first sparked your interest specifically in this particular object?
Well, I would qualify that by saying there are an awful lot of people who spend a lot of time studying this manuscript. Mm-hmm. I would say I, in terms of actually having my hands on it, I'm probably one of the people who has done that the most, just mm-hmm. for just to be
full totally disclosure, true. Yes. Footnote.
Right. So I first met the Voynich manuscript, and I do think of it in anthropomorphic terms.
I mean, it's had a long life, so I'm
yes,
not surprised.
Exactly. Yeah. I think of it as my friend. I first was introduced to the Voynich manuscript when I was in graduate school at Yale pursuing my PhD there. In my very first year, I took a course called Latin Paleography. And paleography is my subspecialty within codicology. And paleography, which will come into play when we talk about my own work on the manuscript, is the study of the history of handwriting, the history of the alphabet.
Ah, okay.
And paleographers like myself are trained to look at a medieval manuscript and from the style of the handwriting, tell you when and where it was produced, mm-hmm. because there are very specific ways that different letters are written over the years. And so in my paleography class, the professor, who later became both my boss and my advisor, brought out the Voynich one day to show us just as an example of this really unusual writing system. And I was immediately captivated by it and wanted to read everything I could about it. My older brother, he's a professor of computer science. Mm-hmm. And so at that time, I reached out to him and I said, surely between the two of us, we're going to crack the case wide open.
We can do it.
We didn't. But that's neither here nor there. So I later became the assistant to the curator who had been this professor. So he became my boss. And if you are the curator of manuscripts at the Beinecke Rare Book and Manuscript Library at Yale University, you have this extraordinary collection that you are responsible for.
I can imagine.
But the cross that you must bear is that you are also the curator responsible for the Voynich manuscript. And that means correspondence, phone calls, now emails, social media posts. There is a huge community worldwide of people who are obsessed with this manuscript. Mm-hmm. And back when I was in graduate school in the 1990s, it became part of my job to answer correspondence about the manuscript. So if somebody wrote to the library and said, could you send me a microfilm of it? Or can you tell me what's on this page? Mm-hmm. Or here's my solution, what do you think? It was my job to respond. So I sort of developed an interest in the manuscript then, but then I went on to do all sorts of other things. You know, after I finished my PhD, I worked for 25 years as a consultant, working for libraries and collections and auction houses, cataloging and studying medieval manuscripts. And it wasn't until about 10 years ago that my interest was really rekindled in the manuscript when this book that you have by Ray Clemens was sent to me by the Yale University Press for a pre-publication review. They wanted me to read the whole thing and give some feedback about it. And that was really what rekindled my interest in the manuscript.
Mm-hmm. And your sort of research into that then, is that focused on the, I mean, yeah, like we said last episode, I don't want to say alphabet, but the writing style?
Yes.
Or
okay. Yes, because at a certain point, I realized as I sort of was catching up on scholarship on the manuscript and what's been done since the 1990s, I kept seeing over and over again, people would say, it looks like maybe there's more than one scribe, who physically wrote the manuscript, but we don't know for sure. We really need a paleographer to take a look
you
at
said,
this.
Wait a second.
Exactly. I saw this revelation. I thought, well, I'm
a paleographer.
I'm a paleographer. This is the job I was born to do. And so Ta-da. That was what I did. I did a very detailed study of specific glyphs, of specific symbols, where they and how they are used and how they are written. Mm-hmm. And established, I mean, to my mind, convincingly, that there are, in fact, five different hands, five different handwritings in the manuscript. And I've sort of mapped their work onto the physical structure of the manuscript, which has resulted in some surprising findings in terms of how the manuscript is put together.
Interesting. I mean, I don't know how much you can say about it now, but like, I feel free to say no comment. Like, whether can you see patterns in, because we talked about before how there's all these bizarre illustrations and things and almost like different themes. So like the women bathing and plants and zodiacs. Can you see patterns between the scribe and particular themes?
Absolutely. So the section with the naked ladies in the baths is entirely written by Scribe 2.
Ugh, Scribe 2, honestly, pages, classic.
Scribe 2, he's really a problem. Or the Zodiac pages are entirely written by Scribe 4. You do have those, that sense that certain scribes had particular interests.
Yeah.
But in addition, the work of Scribe 1 and 2, and then a little bit of 3 and 5, are intermingled in the section on plants in ways that don't really make sense given how medieval manuscripts are structured. And what that means is that it is my conclusion that I have drawn from this is that at least that part of the manuscript is misbound, that the pages are bound out of sequence. And the reason that might be so, we know because of conservation work that's been done on the manuscript at Yale, that there were at least two other bindings before the current one. So it's been rebound several times.
Okay.
The manuscript suffered significant water damage early on in its life.
It's probably all those and women bathing in the baths. And,
you know. Yeah, right, exactly. Someone was trying to reconstruct into what was happening on those pages. I don't know that. Don't quote me on that.
Footnote.
There is a significant staining in the plants section. And parchment doesn't like to get wet.
Oh, interesting.
If a parchment manuscript is damaged by liquid, the immediate thing you want to do is take it apart and let the pages dry. And
put it in a bag of rice equivalent.
And I suspect that is how those pages got misbound. I can't prove that, but it certainly makes sense given the evidence.
Interesting. Oh, that's fascinating. Well, they got, I mean, we say that we don't know anything about this manuscript. We know so much already.
We know quite a lot. Something else that has been discovered by linguists over the years, is that there are two different versions of the language. Of what we call Voynichese that are used in the manuscript. Scribe 1 writes in what's called, quote unquote, language A, and scribes 2, 3, 4, and 5 use, quote unquote, language B. They are very similar, almost like I think if the distinction were established today, a modern linguist wouldn't call them languages. They would call them dialects, maybe, or variants of Voynichese. And so there are consistent patterns. There are letter combinations that are never used and some that are quite common. There are certain glyphs that appear only at the end of a Voynichese word, others that appear only at the beginning. So there are these real patterns that suggest that it is in fact represent a language, whether it's encoded or whether it could be a phonemic transcription of a spoken language or a lost language, as opposed to just being random nonsense. So currently the balance is shifting towards seeing Voynichese as representing a natural human language, as opposed to a made up language like Elvish or just nonsense. We still don't know what language it represents.
Interesting. I mean, it's just fascinating that it's been around for so long in mm-hmm. in terms of research time and, you know, being unable to look at, to decode it. I mean, that's what I find really mm-hmm. fascinating, that there must have been so many different approaches applied to it. So many different yep. researchers looked at it. And
the best code breakers on the planet
yeah.
during World War II were looking at this manuscript. Right.
In their coffee break.
Yeah. And they didn't get anywhere. But of course, today we have a whole new arsenal of tools at our disposal.
Yeah. Well, indeed, I wanted to ask, I mean, are there any kind of new approaches that are being used or are being applied currently
sure.
that might go somewhere?
So it's, you know, there are all sorts of more powerful computing methods mm. that can mm-hmm. be used. So in order to do any kind of analytics on the glyphs, on Voynichese, you first have to put it into a form that a computer can work with. And so there's a substitution alphabet that Voynichologists use. It's called the extensible Voynich alphabet, where this glyph is replaced by the letter T, and that glyph becomes P, and that one becomes O. And those are pretty arbitrary substitutions. They don't have semantic meaning, but it's just so that you can type in Voynichese and a computer can then start doing these really complicated and sophisticated analytics.
Imagine if while putting in those letters, someone accidentally decoded it. Like,
yeah, right, exactly. That would be great.
Wait a second.
Right, exactly. That would be great. So there are all sorts of new strategies. And as I'm now collaborating with several different scientists to keep pushing the work forward. So I work very closely with a linguist who's a professor at Yale named Claire Bowern. I work with a mathematician who's a specialist in computational analytics at the University of Malta named Colin Layfield. I'm currently working with a group of graduate students who are experts in AI image processing on a different strategy. So there are all sorts of really interesting kinds of methods that you can use to try and understand what this object actually is.
Yeah, amazing. And I mean, we've talked also, because I mean, that's sort of in terms of decoding the actual sort of script and things, but in terms of the identifying, we talked already about sort of carbon dating, the problems therein of what does that actually mean? I mean, for example, you mentioned the different scribes and the fact that they were potentially writing in different dialects of Voynichese, but would it be possible to, for example, date the ink or something like that? I mean, are there other kind of other scientific approaches that you think there might give more possibilities of being able to find out even more about the kind of physical manuscript itself in the future?
Possibly. It's very difficult to use scientific methods to date oak gall ink because mm-hmm. it's not from an animal. It's not yeah. animal-based. So carbon-14 mm-hmm. you can't use. All you can really do, at least currently, is break down the chemical components and see if they're consistent with medieval recipes. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much all we can do as far as the ink and pigments go. However, the images were taken about a decade ago of 10 pages using multispectral imaging. So mm-hmm. not just ultraviolet, but a series of exposures from ultraviolet to infrared. And those images that were taken back then sort of disappeared into the ether, and partly because of COVID and staff changes at the Beinecke and a new computer system. Anyway, they just kind of disappeared into the abyss. And of course, that left a part of the Voynich community making comments such as, what is Yale trying to hide? Why won't they release the
of course, yeah.
And, you know, it was just a series of unfortunate events that led to the images just kind of disappearing. But it occurred to me last year that I knew the photographer who took the images. So I emailed him and I said, his name is Roger Easton. I said, Roger, do you have these pictures? And he was like, yeah, I've got them. I didn't know anybody wanted them. And I said, oh, yes, please. I would like them. And so he sent them to me. And the image of the very first page, I discovered something incredibly exciting that no one had ever seen before.
Oh, you tease. Are you allowed to tell us?
Kick it to commercial. So what I found was something that people had seen traces of but didn't really know what it was. So with the naked eye, you can see in the upper right corner the letters A, B, C, D written in a column. Mm-hmm. But you can't really see what it is or what the point of it is. Under the ultraviolet imaging, you can see quite clearly what it is. It's the whole Latin alphabet followed by, next to it, a whole Voynich's alphabet, as it were, a series of Voynich's glyphs, and then another alphabet offset. So it's A, the letter A, a Voynich's character, and then B. And the next row is B, a Voynich's character, C. I have no idea what it means. I knew it. But I did find out something really interesting, which is I could tell, because I am a paleographer, and that's why they pay me the big bucks.
Huge bucks.
I'm kidding. There are no big bucks in this business. What I discovered is that I recognized that the handwriting of those three columns was from the 17th century, just stylistically. And so I went back and I looked at handwriting in correspondence, in letters that had been digitized and were available online, of everyone who was known to own the manuscript in the 1600s. Uh-huh. And I identified whose handwriting it was. Oh. It was Marcus Marci, the guy who sent it to Athanasius Kircher.
Oh, so he'd been trying to decode it.
He'd been trying to do something, but we don't really know what. If it was an attempt to decode it, or was he creating his own cipher with it? We just don't really know what it was he was trying to do. Mm-hmm. And so there may very well be more evidence elsewhere in the manuscript. And so there is a campaign underway to convince the library that it would be worthwhile to image the entire manuscript from start to finish using multispectral imaging to see what we find. Now, the problem there is that handling the manuscript and exposing it to light is dangerous. There's a risk. And so it is entirely up to the library, to the curators, the conservators, the library director, the lawyers, the insurance people, all have to make the decision about whether the potential for discovery is worth the potential risk to the manuscript. And so that's up to them, right? So they know that this would be a great idea, but they're currently undertaking that kind of risk assessment to determine if this is actually something that can realistically be done without harming the manuscript.
Yeah, indeed, because I was thinking, but surely it's non-destructive. So, it's a, deal breaker. But yeah,
well, it's and it's less risk now because of new imaging technologies than it would have been 10 years ago. Yeah. The light exposure, the ultraviolet exposure, the heat exposure is less than it was because of new developments in lighting technology.
Yeah.
But it's really up to them. They have to decide whether, and handling a manuscript is always risky. You risk tearing it, right? You risk adding a fold where there shouldn't be one, or ripping something, or, it's always damaging. And so there's always that question of, do we just put it away on a shelf and never take it out again?
Yeah.
Or then we take it out and let people handle it. And that's, I'm glad it's not my job to make that decision.
Exactly. Oh, yeah, to be honest, now you're mentioning it, indeed, I don't know, because I was initially thinking, yes, do it. But of course,
Yeah, I mean, it's up to them, right? Yeah. It's their object, so it's their decision.
I look forward to seeing what the results will be of the risk assessment. Keeping an eye on.
I did a blog post on my blog, The Manuscript Road Trip, about the multispectral imaging analytics, so we can include that link
I'll make sure to link that. Let's take a very quick break. My tea cup is getting a little empty, but don't worry, everyone, we'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. So, talking again about Voynich manuscript, about the different research things, and I'm very excited to see what the future of kind of the medieval methodologies and scientific methodologies can use to research it. But I want to get a little bit into again the sort of the background of the actual study of the manuscript and the kind of intrigue and the mystery that surrounds it. Because I can imagine, and you sort of briefly mentioned earlier that one of your earlier jobs involved dealing with correspondence regarding the manuscript. Yeah, I can imagine there's a lot of, shall we say, interesting indications that come through. So, I mean, what do you find as some of the sort of, I guess, the challenges that are involved with working with this kind of object, and how do you deal with them?
So over the last few years, I have become kind of a public face of the manuscript because of my social media presence and my own work. And What that means is that often people who have their own ideas about the manuscript will send them to me. Mm-hmm. At just this month, I received 15 solutions to the
Voynich. Oh, solutions even. Great.
That's a record. 15 in 1 month. I have at least 50 in my inbox at the moment.
Oh, wow.
And I used to take a lot of time to respond to people. I would download their work. I would read it carefully. I would write up a whole, you know, series of recommendations. You know, you should read this article. This, you might want to strengthen this point. Here's why your solution really can't possibly be correct. Mm-hmm. And what I discovered is that anyone who writes me and says, I really want to know what you think about my solution, they don't actually want to know what I think. They want
oh my goodness, you're a genius.
Correct. They want me to validate them. And so when I don't, if I don't, and I try to do so kindly and respectfully, the response is always anger or frustration or defensiveness, and including I've gotten threats, I've been called names, I've been insulted on social media. So I don't do it anymore. You know, I just don't do that anymore. But I do get them. I get things sent to me in the mail. I get things sent to me by email, on social media. People tag me. There's just a huge community of people who are interested in this manuscript. And what I generally tell people now is, you know, Yale doesn't have there's no reward for solving the Voynich manuscript. There's no money in this at all. There's like zero money to be made. People seem to think there's some huge reward waiting for them, but there is
not. That'd be great.
Yale is totally agnostic on the question. They are not going to validate any solutions.
Yeah.
But what it means is that there's this very thriving online community. There are several discussion boards where people go, and I always tell people, just go to this discussion board, post your solution, and you'll get feedback. You'll hear from, believe me, you're going to hear from people. If you want to put it out there, that's the best place to start. Yeah. What it also means is that the manuscript has such a hold on the popular imagination now that there are novels written, almost like fan fiction, where the Voynich is the thing that drives the plot. Mm-hmm. And I collect them. I collect Voynich novels. I have about 20 at the moment. And some of them are absolutely terrible, and some of them are quite wonderful. Mm-hmm. My favorite is a comic book from 2012 of the Avengers. This is canon. This is Avengers canon. In 2012, the Avengers are called to New Haven, Connecticut because someone has stolen the Voynich manuscript.
Interesting.
And I'll send you photos because fascinating. You actually, in the comic book, you actually see the Beinecke Library illustrated and the Avengers standing there in front of the Beinecke Library. And so they go flying all over New Haven and they find the manuscript in a parking garage in New Haven, Connecticut. And where it is being studied by a criminal whose name is Diabolo. And Iron Man says to Diabolo, why did you steal the Voynich manuscript? And he says, well, I stole it because I needed it for my alchemical research. And then I believe it is Black Widow who then says, well, you didn't have to steal it. It's been digitized. You can see it online. I swear, this is canon Avengers comic. It's amazing. Absolutely.
Are you sure this wasn't written by the publicists of, you know, Yale Library?
I know. It's spectacular. And so I own that. That's my favorite piece of Voynich ephemera is my Avengers comic book. And it shows up on, you know, there's a science fiction story about it. There are, you know, blogs, there are people post their solutions, there is fan fiction on the website archive of our own on AO3. There's fan fiction about the Voynich manuscript. It just has this, that because it is such an inscrutable, mysterious object, and it's almost like a Rorschach test in that you can bring anything to it. It's a kind of a blank slate. Yeah. In many ways. And so people impose their own vision of what they want it to be on top of this manuscript, regardless of what the evidence actually says. And I feel like I'm an evangelist for evidence-based research. That is my job here, is to remind people who are interested in this manuscript to do the reading.
Yeah.
Read the Clemens book, go to the websites, read my blog posts, read articles that have been published, do the background reading so that your own work will be consistent with what we already know or suspect about the manuscript.
Yeah, because indeed, I guess that's the big problem is a lot of the people, they come up with these lovely solutions, but they haven't actually checked what's already been done in a lot of these places. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly.
And do you have, because actually I was speaking to a very lovely lady who is currently doing her PhD research on the Gallo-Roman dodecahedra, which I don't know if you are aware of them, but they're another one of these objects which just, we have no clue what they've been used for, but has such a fandom, shall we say, of people who, and she was telling me as well that it can be, you know, scary sometimes how, you know, fanatical people can be and how aggressive they can get indeed in sort of that respect. And I was wondering if based on your kind of extensive experience in this and with dealing with this, what sort of advice would you give to others who might be interested in getting into something like that, but maybe haven't really considered the consequences of that or are currently dealing with the consequences of that? What would be the sort of...
You mean specifically with, as regards the Voynich?
Voynich, sort of mystery objects, I guess, or like objects that have that hold over people that have these reactions.
I would say that you should always start with the facts. Yeah. Always start and go where the evidence leads you instead of starting with an assumption about it and going forward from there. Every solution that I have seen starts by making an unjustified assumption of some kind and proceeds from there. And the assumption then in their work goes from hypothetical to fact. Mm-hmm. Before you know it, they're saying at the beginning, it might be this, but then it becomes, it is that.
Yeah.
And that's really a problem. And as you, I become very adept at finding those moments where an assumption becomes a fact.
Yeah.
And it's really just an assumption. And you really, you have to be straight with your readers. You have to be authentic. If you are putting out a hypothesis or making an assumption, say that, right? I mean, I am the first to say the work that I have done, it's subjective. My paleographical work, it's based on my expertise. It's based on my experience. And so people trust me. They trust my opinion because of that.
Yeah.
But it is subjective. It's my opinion based on where the evidence led me.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's very good advice. So people listening, remember, start with the evidence. Start with the facts.
Yes, always.
Good place to do. Well, I also wanted to ask you a few questions. I'm sure, I mean, we could talk for hours about the Voynich manuscript, I think, but I think we have given a nice overview now. We've given us some sort of nice, insights, I would say. I don't know, do you have sort of a final, I guess, fun fact that you want to share about the manuscript? Your favorite, I don't know, favorite experience?
So I do have an anecdote about Mr. Voynich that I love.
Yes.
That when he brought the manuscript to the States and he sort of debuted it at this conference in Philadelphia in 1919, he then took it on the road.
Oh.
And when he was in Chicago trying to find a buyer, he was at a dinner with a group of librarians and curators from various institutions in Chicago. And he was talking to his dinner companion, a young woman, and he was telling her about this manuscript he owned that was written in a code that nobody could read. And across the table was a federal agent. And he immediately came to the conclusion that Voynich was in possession of a U.S. war code book from World War I, and immediately reported him to the feds, and they opened a dossier on him. They started investigating him. He was a foreigner. He had a thick accent. He was from Poland. He was Jewish. He had all these things that they thought made him suspicious. And he was an anti-czarist. He had been imprisoned in Siberia. He has this whole backstory that's very secretive and dramatic. And so the U.S. government investigated him for several years. And no one could convince them that, in fact, this is not a war book, a war code book from 1915. It's an ancient manuscript going back hundreds of years. And it took several years before he was exonerated. And you can, in fact, read the depositions online. They've all been digitized and are, and you can find them online. And they're fascinating. They're very xenophobic, very much anti-Semitic. Mm-hmm. It's really something to read, the kind of bigotry that he was subject to.
Yeah,
it's fascinating.
Yeah, interesting. Oh, gosh. So, I mean, honestly, this book, you could, you write a book about, well, you have, people have written books about the book.
But,
that's the whole point. That's why we're here today. No, fascinating. So as a sort of final sort of roundup of this two episode special, I wanted to talk a little bit more because we mentioned already your experience with kind of paleography, the fact that you're the sort of specialist in manuscript studies. I noticed that you're also the executive director at the Medieval Academy of America, which sounds incredibly important. So what is the Medieval Academy of America?
And what that's you a do great question.
In your role there?
So it sounds like a place where you go to learn about jousting and drinking.
I was about to say, it sounds almost like sort of Hogwarts for medieval manuscripts.
It is not that. It is not that. It's academy the way that, say, the British Academy of Arts and Sciences or, you know, the Royal Academy. It's that kind of an academy. So it is a learned society that supports the work of people who study the Middle Ages. More than 3,200 members.
Oh, world, wow. Okay.
Mostly in North America, most of whom are scholars, either unaffiliated scholars or faculty or graduate students, who are studying the Middle Ages. And we publish a journal, we give out grants, we have a big conference every year, we publish books, and we give out prizes for books as well. So we're here to support the work of people who study the medieval period.
Oh, there you go. And can anyone join the academy?
Anyone can join at themedievalacademy.org. Sorry, there's no the. That's our email address. The website is just medievalacademy.org. We are a nonprofit in Massachusetts in the United States. And yes, membership is open to anyone who's interested in the medieval period.
There you go. So all those people who are listening in and thinking, I want to study the Voynich manuscript, I'm going to join the Medieval Academy of America and get started and do that.
It's a wonderful community.
Which based on that, so I mean, you've been, you know, you're very experienced with this particular topic group, this particular subject group. For those listening in who might be inspired by these episodes and think, you know what, paleography or, you know, medieval manuscripts analysis sounds fascinating. How can I get into it? Or what should I do? What do you wish that you'd known when you first started? Or maybe something you'd have done differently or any other kind of advice that you'd have in terms of people wanting to study paleography or medieval manuscripts?
So there are two angles to get at this field. One of them is through a PhD or a master's degree. There are lots and lots of programs in England in particular. There are quite a lot. Almost every big university has programs in medieval studies, not just Oxford, Cambridge, but Leeds and Edinburgh and everywhere, King's College, all over the place. And so that's one direction to go. The other is through library science. So if you are interested, as I always was, in working in the context of a library, as opposed to teaching, and I do teach and I enjoy teaching, but it is not my primary profession. I'm a cataloger and a researcher in terms of working with manuscripts. So a library science degree is a very good way to go. And because that then gets you, can get you a job in a special collections department. So some of my former students from Simmons University have got jobs at Cambridge University or at Harvard or at libraries and museums around the world where they work with medieval manuscripts.
Amazing. And would you say it's sort of good to already have a little bit of the practical knowledge that we talked about a little bit in last episode in addition to the kind of medieval background, or is that something you can easily learn during study?
Well, some of it you pick up by doing, right? You pick it up on the job. But there are also specialized courses where you can learn about bindings or the history of handwriting or the history of printmaking or printing at places like Rare Book School at the University of Virginia, where I teach in the summer. And there are other places that have summer programming specifically about working with manuscripts. And those are great ways to get your feet wet without committing to a full degree. You can take a course at the University of London. You can take a course at Cambridge or Oxford. You could go to Leeds, where there's coursework. You could go to Rare Book School in Virginia, or there's a Rare Book School in California. It's a lot of summer programming, and that's sometimes a really great way just to try it out and see how it feels. See if it feels like a good fit. It helps to have some Latin. I will say that's the language component is very important. It can be very difficult to make your way in, you know, to get a job unless you have some Latin and other foreign languages. So that's another thing, another skill that you definitely need to bring to the table.
Okay. So good to know. So no gloves, but Latin.
Yes.
Is the end key. Perfect.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
We're sorted. Great.
Exactly.
Well, I think we've unfortunately come to the end of this particular tea break. But before we go back to our busy days and back to work and deciphering this Voynich manuscript, do you have any, I don't know, exciting events or any plans coming up?
Yes. So I will be on June 13th. I am participating in an online program at the Getty Museum in Los Angeles, where I will be interviewed about the manuscript and discussing it with the curator there, Elizabeth Morrison. That's happening in June, or I should say last June.
Participated. We're doing some time travel here as well.
There is that. I am writing a book about the manuscript.
Exciting. Want to add to the collection?
Yes. And it's actually a book for teenagers.
Oh,
and
amazing.
It's a book about the importance of evidence-based research.
Excellent. Start them young.
Yes, exactly. There's so much disinformation in the world. Mm-hmm. We're constantly being fed disinformation. And it's really important that kids and teenagers develop an understanding of how to determine if what they're looking at is real or true or not.
Yeah.
And having some skills in terms of thinking about critical thinking, evaluating evidence, those two skills are critically important as kids go on to be adults.
Yes.
And so that's kind of the point of the book, even though it's really about, it's about the Voynich manuscript, but the point of the book,
subconscious
lesson we are trying to impart, is about the importance of the evidence-based research.
Amazing. Oh, that sounds fantastic. Oh, I look forward to seeing. Do you have an approximate release date planned, or is it still?
I believe it will be out in 28.
Okay.
But I will. There will be an announcement in the next week or so about it from our agent.
Okay.
There will be a public announcement of the book, and I'll be sure and send that to you.
Oh, excellent. Thank you. Oh, and also, I mean, if people want to then follow you and make sure that they are aware of when it's released or aware of any other projects or events that you're participating in, where can people find you?
Yeah, Blue Sky.
Perfect. Yep. Excellent. Well, and I'll make sure to put those links in the show notes for anyone listening.
Great.
Well, thank you so, so much, Lisa, for joining me. It was extremely enlightening. I mean, we learned that we don't really know much, but we learned that we know a lot, surprisingly, actually, about Voynich manuscripts.
Yes, and we've just scratched the surface. There is so much more to learn and so much more.
Yeah, but that's
so
fine. We scratched the surface, but maybe we can use UV light to look at it again, and then we'll be able to see what was scratched away.
Oh, I see what you did there.
I learned something.
Thank you so much for having me, Matilda.
Thank you for joining me.
Really a pleasure.
Well, and I hope that all of you listening also enjoyed this tea break. And if you did, as always, please do like, follow, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to check out the other shows on the APN for more fun archaeology content. And if you'd like to learn more about the Voynich manuscript or about all of Lisa's work and the exciting projects coming up, you can find all the links and contact information in the show notes. Thank you for joining me on this tea break. If you like this episode, please do like, follow, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to check out the other shows on the APN for more fun archaeology content. And if you'd like to learn more about the topic of today's episode, make sure to check the show notes for links and further information.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.